Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. This is Chaim Schmidt from the Kosher Scene. This evening, our topic is La Cucina Judea Italiana, and my guest is Walter Potenza from Potenza Ristorante in Providence, Rhode Island. He happens to be a very prolific chef, happens to be the author of an upcoming book, 19 Ghettos, The Life and Food of the Jews in Italy After the Inquisition. Good evening, Walter.
Good evening to you, Chaim, and thanks for inviting me.
It's a pleasure. I understand that you're one of America's foremost culinary historians on Jewish food and food in general. Now, why particularly Jewish food? What attracted you to Jewish food?
I believe, Chaim, that every one of us have a specific call when it comes to the kind of pattern life that we choose. And with me, culinary has been has given me the opportunity to protect my Italian heritage through food, to protect the regionalism and the authenticity of Italian cookery. In addition to that, through a specific and a particular family issue about my dad, which was involved in a war in Italy for many, many years. He has had a great career in the Italian army. I discovered of his connection with Jewish heritage, and that created this kind of interest in Jewish cookery and a Jewish cuisine, which I decided to investigate deep further, and has brought me to 26 years ago to begin this quest of searching the food and connecting them with the people, the Jewish people who had been living in Italy for over 2,000 years, and among all of the groups that we had in Italy, the Jews and the Italian lived in perfect harmony for centuries. And I thought that food was what spurred the friendliness. I think that food connected the two religion. And I'm sure through the years they've had a diversity and different beliefs, but I believe that at the end of the day, what Italians and Catholics think of a table and what the Jews think of a table, it's the ability to connect family members and keep them there together for a generation to come, to unite them. That's why I believe it has been so prolific for me and so exciting. I did a journey of all the 21 ghettos that the Italian government has recognized as historical sites for the Jewish heritage, and I walked through every one of them. In many of them, there are still evidence of well-kept synagogues, streets that still have some remnants of past life. And in other areas, those evidence have been canceled. If you go in southern Italy, in the city of Trani and Puglia, for instance, what was one time a ghetto and an area of where Jews educated many students, and it was a very cultural site, it was turned through the years into a Christian church. However, there are evidence typically like Casale Monferrato in Piedmont, in Venice, the Ghetto Vecchio, certainly not to mention the Roman ghetto area of Ferrara, a small ghetto in Urbino, which is certainly a capital city for education in Italy, are evidence of a past life, a life that was thriving, a life that had its own uncertainty, I'm sure its own neglect and negativity, because the Jews went through many years of confinement, liberated, reconfinement, just up and down of their life. It's enough to say that the durability of the strength of the Judaism as a religion and as people. So,
in 1977, the first time I went to Rome, one of the first places I visited was the Roman ghetto, right next to the old Roman Forum, Lungo Tevere Cenci. I found it interesting that it was completely surrounded by walls, fortress-like walls, with the papal arms at the entrance, because each pope, even the most anti-Semitic, even Alexander VI, Borgia, as anti-Semitic as he was, he defended the Jews inside the ghetto. Nobody was allowed to touch the Jews inside the ghetto. Once they went out, they were fair game. But inside the ghetto, you couldn't touch them. That was, you know. So it was very interesting to me, the ambivalent feeling. On the one hand, the Jews inside, that's fine, we'll protect them. Outside,
you're on your own.
Right. One of the interesting things I found in that ghetto, many of the buildings come from the times of the Romans. And on each building, there was a plaque, a metal plaque, copper, saying when the family had originally moved there. And it's interesting that the people who live there now are the descendants, son after son after son after son, of the original families. That was extremely interesting. Right outside of the fortress, they have this beautiful, beautiful synagogue that they was originally built in the year 1200. Still not finished after all these centuries. But it's beautiful, and it's interesting that on each seat you have the name of whoever it is that owns. One guy is consigliere, ingegnere, you know, all those titles. They're all very proud of their titles. Absolutely. Name is not enough.
Titles are big enough.
Right. So, you know. And there is a nice little restaurant inside that ghetto with very interesting food. In fact, that's where I first discovered Carciofila Judea, which is, I'm told, it's one of the jewels of Italian cuisine.
Especially in the city of Rome, for the simple fact, Haim, that in Rome we have artichokes, that specific area called Cimaroli, the purple artichokes, which are only used around the Roman territory. The Cimaroli don't have the pungency of the spike of the leaves at the top. They're much easier to cook, and also they get very tender. And around the Passover is one of those dishes that it's really the presentation of the past, of the Judaism, of the Jewish cookery. The typically friggitoria, because, as you know, to make ends meet, one of the first jobs for the Jews was to create what today we call street food. That was invented by the Jews. Street food of today, where you have samples of food on the sidewalk all over Manhattan, Boston, Providence, wherever we might be, that is an antecedent of the Jewish cookery, of the fried artichokes, or many of the permitted meats that you could eat were the Jews were allowed to eat themselves and to sell to the Italian Gentiles. So certainly artichoke is one of them, along with many, many others who are part of the Roman cuisine, which, as you said, are embedded inside the Roman culture of food today.
As a matter of fact, and I don't know how true this is, but somebody told me that the first pizza ever made was made by Roman soldiers who happened to be in Israel, in what is Palestine at the time. And basically it was matzah with tomato sauce. That was the original pizza.
That's interesting. I mean, we've had through the years a certainly discovery. This quest of searching food for me, typically eggplant, fennel, and many other vegetables that have never been part of the Italian culinary repertoire and are today considered to be Italian dishes, are not Italian dishes. I think that's the excitement of this research about Jewish cookery and the research of the ingredients, where they came from, how they grew. Because there is certainly a big disconnect when you look at cookery. When you understand the territory and you understand agriculture, you understand that some ingredients just didn't grow in Italy.
That's correct.
And so how did they get there? And if you go back, when it comes to food, certainly how the spices got into Italy, and Jewish people controlled all the ports, so they controlled the shipping business, and that's the only way you could get...
Plus, a lot of Jews happened to be in the spice business.
Absolutely.
It was a very lucrative business.
That's the only way you could have got them to other countries. You
right.
could move from one place to another. And that's the beauty about history, and that's the beauty of connecting history to the world of Judaism and the world of food that belongs to the Jews. And that's, I think, why today I am here, to try to make a statement, to try to say, listen, some things are important for the public to know. People should know why some ingredients have been used in this specific area and this specific time. And that's why I believe that if we're able to have a Jewish cookery pick up more of a national exposure, I think that we all win out of this. Not for anything other for simply for the knowledge of it, you know, to share the history.
Well, one of the things about food and food history is that it's a very, very fascinating subject. Fascinating because not only does it tell you about something about what it is you're eating, but it tells you something about your ancestry. That's what makes it interesting. If I understand right, you were trained as a historian, and that is how you got through your interest into food. Care to explain a little bit?
Yes, of course. I believe, Haim, that the technical aspect of cooking, it's somewhat interesting. If you and I get together for 30 days and we chop the same onion, you're going to be as good as me. And the technical ability is in every one of us. That's one aspect of cooking. What it's hard to do that people as chefs have that other people don't have, who don't choose this profession, is the ability to do it all the time, to constantly charge yourself, to regenerate yourself, to renew your belief in food, but most of all to have a trained palate. The trained palate comes from research in history, because you understand where food came from, how we got to this point, and you connect that with the chemical aspect. What happens to a specific ingredient once it's under heated condition? What happens? So food at a raw temperature has one taste. At the boiling temperature has another one. When it's fried, it has another taste. When it's poached, when it's baked, it has another taste. And that's, I think, the intriguing aspect of that.
I must take issue with something you said. It isn't merely technical ability, which, of course, is absolutely necessary, but it takes much more than technical ability to prepare a great meal. It takes passion, it takes love, it takes understanding of the nuances of flavor, which the average cook at home never can master.
It's true, Hyman. It's funny you say that. As often many of our customers at the restaurant will say, you know, I cooked last night and my food was as good as yours. You know, for one night I can cook. And I agree. For one day, most people can cook like a professional chef. However, to do it for 40 years, it's very hard to do. Because you are driven by a specific aspect of cooking, which are not connected with just merely cook and the passion. And I agree with you. The research for the ingredients, the source, the origin, but most of all, the ability to create memories in people's life every day is very important. And I think chefs do that because we bring back memories, we bring back celebration, we bring smile to people every day. And I often say a chef has a moral commitment to the health and the well-being of others. We have to watch the ingredients that we use. We have to watch the health of the people that we serve every day. So I agree with you on that.
There is an old Jewish legend, an old parable, about this street violinist who was playing this incredibly beautiful piece of music that made people laugh and people cry and laugh. And it was overwhelming. Everybody would stop to listen to him. Eventually, this particular violinist came to the attention of the prince of the city, and the prince had him brought to him, and every day he would have to play for the prince. This went on for a while, but after a while, the violinist got bored, always playing the same piece for the same person. He lost, you know, some of the passion. And of course, his playing was not quite the same. The prince then decided to blind him, and every day they would tell him that there was a new person. And as he believed that there was a new person there, again he renewed all his passion, and he played with incredible joie de vivre. And the same thing can be said about a chef. The chef uses food as his instrument, and when he makes that delicious piece of food, when he makes that delicious dish, that incredible dish that makes people say, wow, this, I could never have done it like this, no matter how many years I have cooked, that is precisely because he has renewed his passion. He has renewed his feeling. And I believe that basically a good chef is the same as a great violinist, the same as a great artist, with a canvas, the instrument, or whatever media being the food.
I agree, and thank you. That's a great analogy. It's one that I'll use to some of my staff. And but when it comes to the history of the food, I think I am taken by the religious aspect of Jewish cookery, and the ability to put together all the ingredients specific time of the year for celebration, and you know, of all the major holidays that you have, it's amazing how certain ingredients reappear on those holidays. And we try to do exactly the same thing in our restaurant, try to celebrate those times, because as you know, many people, as they've aged, they're not able to cook anymore. So we try to create these memories for them and try to share with them what we know, what I've learned through the years and my connection with the Jewish world. And we hope that we leave memories to them. It's funny because every Passover, I always have a Jewish grandmother will say to me, my matzah balls are better than yours. And I go to the table as I walk up and down, and I'll say, I'll invite you the next time. Maybe you'll work with me. And I found that that's the best secret. Never try to argue your Jewish grandmother. Try to invite her in your kitchen and say to her, please come over and help me do that, and they forever love you. You know.
I once interviewed the man who started out the Tofuti company, and he tells me that before starting the Tofuti company, he had a delicatessen, a very successful delicatessen, and once a Jewish grandmother came in and told him, you know, I can make a better chicken soup than you can. So he says, tell you what, I challenge you. He says, he challenged her, and he actually learned how to make chicken soup. He says, after that, a few other grandmothers would come, and he would always bring them in once or twice into the kitchen. He would learn their secrets, and then he would develop it even better. It was a great idea.
I absolutely agree with you. I think that there is something to be said about past generation who, in this country of ours, I think that food that has taken too much of a spin in the industrialized idea. I don't think our new generation. I look at my kids. My daughters are both married. They don't have the same passion that their mother have, or myself, obviously. And so if we are able to maintain some of these recipes for the time to come, to try to share them with generation that follows, I think we'll do a great justice to them, because, as I often say, food is the representation of its people. When you meet someone for the first time, it's about food that you share memories. And the similarity of a Jewish-Italian table, it's so very close, meaning that I believe that the Jewish table invites family, friends, and children to stay togetherness, to generate unity. And I think that we did the same thing in the Catholic Church growing up with my mom and dad. That's what we remember. We remember just being together. Everybody ate at the same time. Mom was always the person who served everybody, and then she sat down last. And so, and I believe it is the same with the Jewish folks. And so that similarity is interesting, and it will forever be treasurable by me.
One of the things that has been lost in American culture, one of the things that I grew up with in Uruguay, in South America, we always had lunch as a family. And in spite of how young I was, at lunch, we always had a bottle of vino. You couldn't sit down to eat without vino. That was uncultured. That was uncivilized. And the whole family ate together, and there was something beautiful about it, even though it happened day after day after day. Here in America, we've lost that. In Europe, it still continued to a certain degree, but we're losing it fast. Another thing that I dislike about America is the processed food. For example, American cheese. Cheese-like processed food. It's the laughing stock of the world.
Exactly.
There is a kosher company in Manhattan that brings Italian cheeses, like Scamorza, Lo Spadone.
Si.
There is nothing like it in the States. It's incredible.
It's America has changed its dietary habits. I think that's an incredible, interesting subject because, as you know, obesity has taken over this country and it's a national epidemic. And that goes back to exactly what you said, the production of food. Not enough food cooked at home, not enough fresh ingredients. The lack of knowledge among a new generation on the ingredients and their inability to read ingredients. It's funny because in this country we don't understand the clock of nature. Clock of nature to a chef is the ability to cook when the ingredients are at top conditions. Excuse me. And so in this country we want a blueberry in January. We don't care where they come from. We just want it at the table. And if you don't have it, sometimes they come to our restaurant and say, "Oh, but you don't have tomatoes and it's February." No. In order for me to have a top of the line tomatoes, I would have to grow them in a greenhouse. It's February in Rhode Island. There's snow outside. And that's kind of what they don't understand about food. The clock of nature is the respect of the ingredients because nature does 90% of the work for you. All you have to do is watch nature. As they give you the ingredients, you just work them and use the rule of three, which is what Italians do. Rule of three means more than three ingredients in a plate are usually too many. And so it's like having three people living together. We can live together for a week, two, a month, even 3 months. After that, we start to get on each other's nerves, let's face it. So I think that you're right about that. Processed food is it's a no-no, but the freshness of Italian cookery, as you know, and Jewish cookery, it's about the vegetable, it's about the grains, it's about whatever area of the world that they came from. And then the fact of the wine, that's another issue of why wine among Italian kids, when you're 2 years old, you begin with three-quarter of an inch wine, and usually dad or grandfather at the table adds a little bit of water. And as you grow older, there's less water added and more wine that replaces. Right. So that, I think that's
not just Italian kids. That's when I started.
Exactly.
That's when my kids started.
Absolutely. So,
for example, every Friday night for the Sabbath, we start the meal with wine, with a blessing on wine. And since my kids were little babies, sitting in their plastic seat, I would put them on the table and put a few drops of wine on their lips.
Nothing wrong with that.
Nothing wrong with that.
No, absolutely.
And they didn't have to wait to be 18 till they could have their wine. And another thing about American foods, for example, my parents were from Poland. One thing that was very popular among Eastern Jews was something that they called gribenes. What is gribenes? It's rendered chicken fat.
Right.
Any cardiologist today will tell you that that stuff will kill you.
Right.
That's a guaranteed triple bypass. And yet, my generation had it. We never had any problems because it was fresh. It was made as needed, the moment it was needed. And unlike Americans, we didn't drive everywhere. We walked. We exercise.
You killed some of that.
Exactly.
Yes, that's exactly. True. No, that's very true. And it's the case with a lot of ingredients that we certainly could go on and on of our food has become, from a pleasure, has become a necessity. And the moment it becomes a necessity, the country finds its way to make it available at any cost, at any time. And so if you want to have food that doesn't have any time expiration, you have to eat manufactured food. And if you want to have a healthy lifestyle, manufactured food don't belong in anybody, and in any one of us, especially children, who have a clean body, a brand new body, brand new lungs, brand new veins, and so on. So, we need to always remember that fresh food is the key, and prepared very minimally. Buy the best you can afford and don't work it too much. That's really the answer for good cooking, I believe.
When you said about prepared very minimally and only three ingredients, you remind me of one of the guests that I had on my radio show. Tells me that he's an Italian boy. He graduated from the CIA, from the Culinary Institute of America. And right after graduation, he went back home and he told his mother, "I'm preparing pasta like you never had it before." She was having some friends over. He prepared the pasta using 31 ingredients. It took him 6 hours. Yes, the pasta was incredible. The friends could not believe. After a week, he decided, okay, enough vacation, time to work. He goes and applies at the restaurant, at an Italian restaurant, and he brags to the owner, I just prepared pasta with 31 ingredients. It took me 6 hours. And the guy says, you want to be hired? What are you, crazy? This is a restaurant.
You can't do this. Not just the time, but most of all is the conflicts of ingredients.
Conflicts of ingredients, the price that you would have to charge if you use that many ingredients, and who is going to wait 6 hours for the pasta?
Wait for you for a dish, and it's exactly. But there are ingredients who don't belong with each other. I'll give you a quick example. In our cooking school that we run, I often explain why some ingredients just don't jive. They don't belong with other ingredients. So you look at an asparagus, tall, slender, skinny, fit, if you look at an asparagus, it calls for a little bit of butter. It calls for a royal ingredient like a sprinkle of Parmigiano, maybe under a grill a little bit to grill a little bit to give it a color. Or as they would do in France, they would do with a very rich Hollandaise sauce. And on the other side, an asparagus will never be in the same room with a pepper. A pepper is chubby, round. It looks like a big nose. It doesn't have a pretty, it's flavorful, but it doesn't have a pretty appeal. And so an asparagus will never be seen, will never get caught dead with a pepper on the same plate. And so often look at ingredients, see what they are able to bring to the table, understand the mineral aspect, understand what they carry with them in terms of nature, what are the ingredients that they release during cooking process. That's where science comes into place. That's the ability for the ultimate picture of the dish. Some ingredients just are not meant to be together. You know, sage does not belong on all pasta. Sage belongs with a ravioli filled with a little bit of cheese, with spinach, and with a little bit of butter. But sage does not belong with the red tomato because it has an effect inside an ingredient that they release during cooking process that throws an unpleasant flavor to the tomato sauce, which has already acid. And so we could go on and on for this for a long time to try to understand of why some ingredients don't belong with others, and yet they pair well with others, you know, with seafood or many other ingredients. So, and so that's the challenge behind the chef, and try to understand, try to educate the palate of my staff, the palate of the people that we have working for us. When we do these holidays, you know, we hire American young people, and to them, I have to sit down for an hour and explain to them the history of a Passover, the history of, in my own little limited knowledge, the history of the Rosh Hashanah, what it means, why the numbers, the numerical numbers classify the years of the you know, and so it's very brand new to them. And I often discourage staff because it's not that easy to work here.
any good chef, I've learned, has to be a dictator.
Well, it's, I mean, in a pleasant way, you need to implement it. Look, this is a restaurant history. This is a restaurant where I'm driven by research, where I'm driven by my ability to never be fulfilled unless I have new notions about other people and how they live their life. You know, I chose two topics in my life. Customers ask me, would you like to see, have you ever gone to a Chinese or a Mexican restaurant? I said, I just cannot be drawn into try to understand Chinese food or Mexican food. Not because I don't like it or because I don't respect their heritage. It's because in my life, I will never have enough time to understand my own culture and the Jewish culture which I'm connected to. And so the years that I'll be spending, whatever the Lord decides to give me, I'll have barely enough time to spend to understand my own countrymen, my own culture as Italian, which it seems that every time I go back home, I learn something new about my own blood, and that of the Jewish heritage, because I am here to tell a story about this father of mine that I had who passed away, was never able to tell what he did in the history of his life, and maybe I'm here to share an evidence of to shine a light on his life, you know.
There is another secret about great food, and I would like to know your opinion on it. Briat Savarin, a French gastronome and politician of the 19th century, wrote in his book La Physiologie du Goût, The Physiology of Taste, that 97% of the experience of a new dish that we never had before is not the taste. That is merely 3%. The other 97% is what my eyes see and what my nose inhales, what my nose picks up. How true is that?
Yes, I agree with that, especially because the stomach doesn't have a gauge. The brain has the gauge. The brain has the ability to collect in this file the flavors that we encounter in our life and the eye appeal of something. Why is everyone say, you know, my grandmother's food was the best? It's not because it was really the best, but because it was memory food. It was the first food. It was something that we were placed in front at such early age. So that file, the brain picked up those filing and placed it there. And you may not have the same dish for 30 years, and when it reappears again, the file comes up and certifies that you've had it before. This was something that my grandmother made. I think that the olfactory senses, I think that all your tongue and all the feelings that we have in our tongue are able to collect all these files together, and the visual appeal of a dish, they are placed in our brain, and I think that that's how you identify a dish. Because at the end, once the food is chewed and is placed in the first stomach, I think it's barely remembered. What is important to remember is in the first impression that we got and how it was prepared and the time of life that it appeared. I think that is so well said. But Lazzo Savarino was a great gastronome and a philosopher. And actually, the dish that was invented after him, the Savarin, the dessert, we don't see enough in restaurants, actually. And maybe I should make one of them one of these days.
Back in Uruguay, Savarina was my favorite dessert. In Israel, the Savarin also was my favorite dessert. Here in America, I never found the kosher Savarin. I've never seen it anywhere.
We do make in some of our cooking classes, we top it usually with fresh fruit on the inside, you know, or sometimes a light cream. But, that's another thing, dessert. The dessert is part of this American culture where for us, whether you're from Europe or South America or the Middle East, a dessert was identified as a celebratory moment. So a dessert could be had at 4 in the afternoon. Then have no connection with dinner or lunch.
Absolutely.
Where with us, there was always some dry fruits, some nuts, some fruit. There was always an orange. There was always cherry, figs, whatever was in season. And when I came in this country 40 years ago, I realized that the dessert for American-born was part of the meal procedure, if you will. So it was the four-course meal included dessert. So that was, to me, was very new because I didn't think that was a... So in addition, what they did, they would have a protein, carbs, protein, or whatever else, and then at the end, ended the meal with another carbohydrate, which to me, physically, it's a killer because the carbohydrates, unless you walk for about 10 miles, you'll never burn off the sugar. So these are some of the things that we've never been able to teach. But, you know, in restaurants, you have to do what the customers demand to be in business.
Right.
So... But it was always a celebratory dessert for us. So Savarin was one of them.
And that's one of the things that you notice as you travel throughout Europe. Even though Europe today is no longer what it used to be, it's still far more conscious about the health properties of whatever it is you're eating, whereas in America, they have long lost that.
This country needs to have a completely overhaul on the education system. What I mean by that is... I'm not an experienced on education, but I can say that Europeans go to school 6 days a week. A child that goes to school on Saturday, and I remember me taking religion on Saturday, taking agriculture on Saturday, certainly they don't want to be there. But to me, it's new that students go to school 5 days a week here. They think that that's a lot of school time. In the Orient, they go to school 6 days a week. We're the only industrialized world that our children go to school five. But most of all, I think in subjects, I think that subjects such as finances and elementary food should be two subjects that they should learn about.
Absolutely.
I think that our children don't have the right understanding of food, the right education of ingredients, the dangers of overeating, eating cheap ingredients, and they don't have certainly a basic understanding of credit card and finances. Otherwise, we won't be in the mess that we are.
That's right.
And so these are two things that I think that our kids could benefit. A child at 12, 13 years old in junior high could learn more about food, they could learn more about finance. And these are two things that will help them in their own life. And so, yes, I agree. And as my wife often says, an 11-year-old in Italy knows more about food than an adult here. Because they, you know, they ask questions. They know the, you know, they know the ingredients they see in the market. They see fresh vegetables all the time, and they frown upon ingredients that are not fresh. So that's something that we haven't been able to do here.
Well, going back to what you said about Italy, even before 11, I have an Italian neighbor, and she tells me that she was 9 years old. It was the first time that she prepared dinner for her father. Her mother told her, "You're old enough. Now it's your turn to prepare dinner." She said she prepared dinner to the best of her ability. She was shaking as she was serving it to her father. And when her father smiled, she suddenly felt, "Yes, I can do it."
Right.
And that, let's face it, that's a tremendously reinforcing experience for a child to know that you're no longer the little kid. You're no longer the little girl or the little boy. You're now ready to become an adult.
Absolutely.
And it's done through food.
I mean, I remember, I mean, I tried to teach 11, 12-year-olds here in our school as well. I tried to develop in them the sense of food is not just a something that you consume, but the importance of it. And I think in a preparation, because it certainly is all about creating the sense of I can and the sense of I know how. For health reasons, but most of all for a sense of reassurance and self-esteem. And I think that food does that, just like many technical aspects of life, I suppose.
And we're just about out of time, which is unfortunate because I can continue this conversation for hours. You're a fascinating guest, and we'd love to have you again on our show.
Thank you, Chaim. It's been a pleasure. Thanks for thinking of me. It's always good to be able to talk to people who speak the same language, and I think you do. I think you understand food just like a chef does. Maybe you can cut an onion as quick as I can, but you can probably enjoy the food just as much as I do.
I think I can. I've been a foodie all my life. Thank you very much,
thank
Walter.
You. Thank you. I'll talk to you soon. I hope you invite me again.
We certainly intend to. And thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen. Tune us in again next week. Thank you very much. Good night, one and all.
Yeah, so true.